what you see again and again is an argument that the previous regime was illegitimate, and a kind of linkage of that illegitimacy to the notion that gender relations got out of whack, that women had acquired too much power, that traditional family and gender relations had been subverted. And one of the things that you see with a lot of these leaders is a kind of almost kind of ritualized humiliation of powerful women, women in politics, as part of their macho political ethic.
Authoritarian leaders are on the rise around the world, and one of the ways they gain power and hold on to it is by keeping women down. More on this later, but first, a shocking pattern of illegality. That's what New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood says her investigation found when they started looking into President Trump's charity. She filed suit back in June, and today the president agreed to shut the Donald J. Trump Foundation down. David Farenthold covers the Trump family and its businesses for The Washington Post. He's been following and breaking news on this story for months, and he joins me now. Hi, David.
Hi.
So let's start with the shocking pattern of illegality. What are some of the things the Trump Foundation is alleged to have done?
Basically, there's three categories of things it did that it wasn't supposed to do. One was Trump used the money in his charity, which was supposed to be an independent entity serving its own charitable aims. He used the money from his charity to pay off legal settlements for his for-profit businesses. So he used his charity's money to save his businesses $260,000. He also used his charity's money to buy art portraits of himself, one of which he later hung up as decoration in one of his golf courses. And then he also used his charity kind of as an arm of his presidential campaign in 2016, using it to sort of gather up money and then give it out in the middle of his campaign rallies in Iowa and New Hampshire to burnish his reputation as a rich guy who loved veterans.
And that's allegedly all illegal.
Well, yes. Two of the basic principles of charity law is if you put your money into a charity, the money belongs to the charity. It doesn't belong to you anymore. Even if the charity's named after you, it doesn't belong to you. And so you can't use that money in the charity to benefit yourself, and you also can't use it to participate in any way in a political campaign. So those are the sort of two very, very basic rules of running a charity that Trump seems to have ignored.
Well, three of Trump's adult children seem to have ignored them, too. Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump, and Eric Trump, they're also named in the lawsuit. What's their liability or their connection?
Well, so Trump himself, President Trump, was the founder and the president of this charity his whole life, and that started in 1987. But Ivanka, Eric, and Donald Jr. were on the board of the charity, so by law, they're supposed to be looking out for the charity's assets, protecting it from mismanagement, making sure that the president, their father, wasn't spending the money the wrong way. Not only were they not doing that, the fact they hadn't even met as a board since 1999, long before any of those people were actually on the board. So they weren't doing the job at all. That's why they've been added to the lawsuit, basically for neglecting this legal duty they had to protect the foundation's assets.
Well, I'm remembering back in June when we first talked to you about this story, the president tweeted, and this is the tweet, "The sleazy New York Democrats are doing everything they can to sue me on a foundation that took in $18,800,000 and gave out to charity more money than it took in $19,200,000, and I won't settle this case." So has he had a change of heart about settling?
I mean, this is the way he's always treated settling in lawsuits. He's always said, "I'll never settle this case." And then Trump University, all kinds of things. He always settles. In this case, though, that what he said there, you know, it took in all this money and gave it away, it still seems like he's either like ignorant or ignoring the basic tenets of charity law, which is it doesn't matter whether you use the money in your charity to buy something from a for-profit business or to buy something from another charity. If you're using the money in your charity to buy something for yourself, that's wrong.
Right. Money came in. Money went out, David. What's wrong with that?
Right. Exactly. His argument seems to be as long as he didn't buy a Lamborghini or a yacht with this money, he couldn't possibly have done anything illegal with it.
Well, Trump did try to shut down the charity before this, and the New York Attorney General, Barbara Underwood, wouldn't let him. I imagine shredding has something to do with your answer, but why?
Well, because that's right. At that point in December 2016, when he said he wanted to shut the foundation down, the investigation was still ongoing and went on for another year and a half. And so they said, no, legally, you have to keep it open while we investigate it. And so now their fear was, or what they said their fear was that Trump would give its assets away to you know, charities that benefited himself another time. And so now the assets of the charity will be given away under the supervision of the court in New York State and also by the New York Attorney General. They'll approve who gets the remainder of its money.
Okay, so now the president, now that he's shutting down, we know where the money is probably going, but what about the case?
The two pieces of this lawsuit are continuing. In addition to seeking the dissolution of the charity, Barbara Underwood, the New York Attorney General, also sought two other things. One was to impose financial penalties on Trump himself. She wants him to repay $2.8 million that she said the foundation spent to benefit Trump himself and pay millions more in penalties. She also wants to impose a ban on Trump and his children from them serving on the board of any other charity in New York State. That's the sort of remedy that's taken against scammers and fraudsters. It's not usually applied to someone like the President of the United States.
Now, this is a lawsuit, but does the president face any possible criminal charges?
At this point, all the liability that exists is only civil. The way that the statute's written in New York State, the New York Attorney General's power to file criminal charges in a case like this is very limited, so she did not. She sent referrals to the IRS and the Federal Election Commission, both of which also regulate the Trump Foundation, both of which have the power to bring criminal charges if they feel it's warranted. We don't know what's happened. If anything's happened to those agencies, they haven't commented.
We can't end this conversation without talking about the unforgettable detail of that portrait of Donald Trump that was bought for $20,000 by the charity. What's the latest on that?
Well, so it's incredibly enough, Trump actually bought two large portraits of himself with charity money, one for $10,000 and one for $20,000. The $10,000 one we found with the help of some Twitter followers of mine, found it hanging on the wall of Trump's Doral Golf Resort. The other one, the $20,000 one, we still haven't found. Now, remember, this is the asset of a charity, so it has to be used for charitable purposes wherever it is. My efforts to find it using Google image search and other things have not worked. When I put this picture of the...
I thought it was large enough to be seen from space. How can you not find this, David?
It's 6 feet tall. When I put the picture of Trump's face from that portrait into Google image search to see if maybe a picture of it existed, Google image search decided it was a picture of an orange and said, do you want to see more pictures of orange?
No.
That happened. My attempts to find it so far have failed.
Always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for this.
Thank you.
David Farenthold, he's a Washington Post reporter. LA Unified announced today that it's reached a salary agreement with the teachers union, UTLA, after months of negotiations and threats of a teacher's strike. The district said the agreement was reached after a state-appointed fact finder recommended a 6% raise, matching the district's offer from September. But when we reached out to the union directly today, we were told that no agreement had been made. And there are other major disagreements between the district and the union on class size, standardized testing, and staffing, which means teachers could still strike next month. So we decided to talk to a teacher about all of this, Vicky Montes. She's an English teacher and department chair at Bravo Medical Magnet School near LA County USC Medical Center. Hi, and thank you for coming on the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, first things first, it appears the union and the district are just not on the same page regarding the salary agreement. What's your reaction to this reported 6% raise?
The fact that the district and the union are not on the same page is basically emblematic of why we're here. that's my initial reaction is, of course, they aren't on. One says we've reached agreement, one says we haven't. And that's kind of the frustration that we as teachers feel is you're never on the same page with us. It seems like we're working against LAUSD for the benefits of our own students all the time.
So ongoing confusion. What are you hearing from your colleagues? Do you think we're still headed for a strike?
I do think we're still headed for a strike, especially because it's not about the raise alone. I would never go on strike simply because of a pay raise. I mean, 6% is really just a COLA raise for the last 2 years. I was a seventh grader in 1989, and I hated being at my school. My students, my teachers were on strike. But I changed my tune this year because I just feel like our students are not being served anymore by this district. And it isn't about the money. It's about lowering class sizes and less testing. My juniors this year are going to take 9+ standardized tests, which means they're losing 16 days of instruction. I think that they need 16 more days of instruction, less testing. Our class sizes are huge. I have 34, 35, and 36 students in my 12th grade English class. I'm teaching writing, so it's very hard to teach writing once a month to 180 students. And yet, we're just supposed to just continue on. And if the students fail, that's okay, because the district has bought online credit recovery classes where students can just replace the class in a weekend if they fail. So I don't have a lot of pull to really work with kids that are struggling, because they know they can just make it up. And this is all district initiatives. This isn't anything to do with teachers, and we never get a say.
Well, the frustration and the pain comes across so well in your voice. I imagine, were you pretty clear? Was this not a difficult decision for you to strike, or is it still a difficult one because you know what it means to students?
You know, initially, I would tell you, like, if you talked to me last year, I was never going to go on strike. But it has become more and more clear as I just really reflect on that I don't think the district is working well for my students, and I feel like I want to stand up for my students. I advocate, I try to teach them how to advocate for themselves, and I feel like this is me advocating for them. And so it has not, it's no longer a difficult decision. I also feel like if you just follow the money, I feel like there's too much that makes no sense to me in terms of what's coming into our district. And I don't want, you know, billionaire investors being able to take over our district in the guise of helping. Like, that concerns me greatly, because I don't think for-profit ever helps education. It doesn't help our low-income students to have billionaires have a say in their education. They should have become teachers if they wanted to help out so badly. You know, ask me what we need. Our school's very successful, but no one ever asked me.
Well, there is this perception, though, among some parents that the union and striking teachers are more concerned about themselves than the best interests of their students, despite what all everything pretty much we have talked about in this conversation. And I imagine have you had difficult conversations with parents who do talk to you about these things and talk to you about them along those lines?
I have definitely heard from some parents, and you know, I'll be honest, I've more of my parents at my son's school, or my some of my friends who are teachers and their parents, and I mostly communicate through my students, simply because 85% of our students are bused. So my conversation with parents are the concern of the loss of instruction for their students. But I've told them I would try to make sure that the impact wouldn't be great. When we came back, we'd have stuff we were definitely doing. And when you tell them that it's about the lower class size, it's trying to get a nurse on my son's elementary school campus every day, not just one day a week. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about not having to, you know, I have students with a ton of needs, and it's hard to differentiate for 36 kids. But when I first started teaching, it was 20-1 for English. I could meet those needs. So when you tell the parents it's not about the money, it's about ensuring that your student has the absolute best resources and best day and best learning, they're a little more on board with supporting us, because that they see it. They see it every day. You know, there's not mental health resources. It's just testing, testing, learning, learning. You know, we're done.
What about your students? How do they feel about this and about the possibility of a strike?
The students are very supportive. You know, we spent a day trying to leaflet them during the week last week to invite them all to the rally, because we're not allowed contractually to talk to them during instructional time. So the only time we get is like after school. And they were, you know, we'll be there, miss, we'll be there. I mean, you know, as many of them said that, I don't know everyone that did, but they understand, because they're the ones that are affected by what we're fighting for. You know, they're the ones affected by packed classrooms. They hate the food. You know, they're like, can you get us better food? You know, they have their own concerns and their own, you know, they know what they would like to see change. So they're also supportive.
Well, you mentioned nurses. There has been a nursing shortage nationwide and in certain regions, and that's what the LAUSD cites when it comes to a sticking point on that issue. But you've been teaching in the LAUSD since 2000. What's your experience with negotiations like this in the past? Is this different?
It feels very different, because in the past, you know, the union went into negotiations and there was always an agreement. You know, like the union would kind of shoot for the sky and the LAUSD would lowball it and they'd come to an agreement. And that's what always seemed to happen. And this feels very different, because it seems like the district has chosen to just block the negotiations. Like, no matter what it's going to be, we're going to block it. We don't have the money. No matter, we agree with you that all those things would be great for students, but we just don't have the money, end of discussion, when there always seemed to be a discussion in the past. I think we do have a really good, strong union leadership for the first time in my career, I got to say. So that definitely helps, that they are continuing to fight for the right things. Like, in the past, it was always just a raise. This is the first time I've seen all of these other issues that really make a quality school system, and they're fighting for those, and I respect that. And I just just think it seems like Buettner was brought in to be the wall. You know, he's a businessman. He's going to be able to say no.
Now, you were there when thousands of teachers marched in downtown L.A. just this past Saturday. So give us a sense of the mood there. How motivated were your fellow teachers, marchers, to strike?
Oh, that was amazing. That I cannot tell you. It felt so good because nobody wants to go on strike. Nobody wants to leave their kids. Nobody got into this profession to make a lot of money. It's not about the money. So to be able to leave our students and potentially go outside and strike is painful, but to be with that many like-minded people, and that was teachers and support. My dad came with me. My kids came with me. It was so empowering to see, like, this many people can't be wrong, and this many people wouldn't be fighting for a pay raise. This many people are fighting for a better school system. So it was incredibly empowering.
Well, I hope this can all be worked out, and I want to thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I agree. I hope it can be worked out, too.
Vicky Montes is an English teacher at Bravo Medical Magnet School. Coming up, Molly Hennessy Fisk of the LA Times tells us what she's been reporting along the Texas-Mexico border, the cat and mouse game of Border Patrol and immigrants, and the town of residents caught in the middle. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Madeline Brand. President Trump today said he would seek different sources to pay for the border wall, signaling perhaps that he's backing down from the threat of a government shutdown. Well, news like this affects all Americans, but for those who live along the border, it literally impacts what may happen in their front yard. Molly Hennessy Fisk has been writing about life in the border town of Roma, Texas. She's Houston bureau chief for the LA Times, but she moved to Roma for a few months and continues to travel there. It's a place where residents grapple with uncertainty about the wall, and border agents often mistrust the residents themselves. Molly, it's good to have you on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
So this town, Roma, has a long history with smuggling people across the border from Mexico to the U.S., as you write. And it sounds like people live there, they just come into regular contact, both with smugglers and Border Patrol agents and immigrants, or at least see the action happening around them. What kind of stories do people tell you about what they see just from their porches and windows?
Yes, it's true. There was definitely a large Border Patrol presence, and it was almost what you might imagine a police presence would be in a neighborhood. Regular patrols, you would see the helicopters in the morning, the Border Patrol boats zooming down the river at night. You could hear them even from inside your houses.
And what's their attitude toward border control? Is there much contact between them?
Yeah, I had talked to some people who said that they had tried to contact Border Patrol and report things to them. And in some cases, Border Patrol responded, or it took a long time. For instance, one woman talked to me about a house in the neighborhood, a stash house, where she had seen, you know, immigrants going inside, and she didn't trust the people who lived there, and she had reported it, and it took a while for Border Patrol to bust them. Other people said they felt like Border Patrol considered them suspects or thought that they were smugglers, and they worried about approaching them on the street because they thought other neighbors who they suspected were smugglers might think that they were snitches.
Oh, so complicated. So they're caught between, they're beset on all sides, it sounds like.
Well, yeah. And then I also, you know, had talked to the Border Patrol commander for the area and went out and did some ride-alongs with Border Patrol on the water and on the, you know, in the area. And the commander was saying, you know, sometimes you have people come forward and turn people in as smugglers or snitch on them and say that they're smugglers. And it turns out those people themselves are smugglers and they're just trying to foil the business of this other smuggler. They're, you know, competition.
So I imagine it's hard for agents to rely much on information from residents. And you write that they don't, that they really, they patrol. And it sounds like it's a really unique situation. It's just not policing as usual that Border Patrol is doing in these border towns.
Yeah, I think the Rio Grande Valley in particular, part of the reason we chose to focus on it, it is the busiest crossing for, immigrants crossing the border illegally in the entire border. The volume of people that they're seeing even since we left has just continued to increase, in particular migrant families. And we saw some of that in our neighborhood. I saw on several occasions, a parent with a small child, usually Central American, and residents told me stories of, coming home and there were migrants sitting on their lawn or, kind of collapsed on their lawn with a small child with them. And so then the decision becomes, what do you do? Do you just go in your house? Do you bring them water? Do you take them into the house? Because then you could get accused of smuggling.
And in terms of the patrolling, I mean, it's complicated. The smugglers, you write, are sometimes dressed as priests. They're dressed as UPS workers.
As pilots. That's what some of the Border Patrol had told me. And so it can be difficult for them to know who they can trust.
And agents, you write, have secret signals that they use while they're patrolling. I remember in one story you wrote that they used a Darth Vader mask nestled in a pecan tree trunk.
That's right. There was a doll, an old doll in another corner. And then they had told us about the, sometimes they just use the nicknames that locals have given to particular landmarks, like a cactus patch or the broken wheelbarrow or, something like that, as a way to signal where they've picked up activity. And then they'll radio it to another agent. And they've mapped out these landmarks so that they can navigate in pretty rural areas.
And the smugglers, of course, have their own secret signs and symbols. What did you encounter?
We were, listening not just to what residents were telling us, but to what was going on in the neighborhood. And we would hear, somebody shouting or singing, or a lot of times you would hear a big chorus of dogs barking all at once. And that usually meant that either the singing or the shouting meant that somebody was signaling to smugglers on the other side that they should cross people over the Rio Grande River. And the barking of the dogs usually meant that the people had arrived.
It must be such an ethical dilemma for the residents of that town. And you write that they feel that they can't behave in any unusual way or draw attention to themselves because that might be interpreted by smugglers as a secret sign that they're communicating with border agents.
Right. Well, one of my neighbors who lived up the street from me said that, and he's a police dispatcher, so he's already pretty careful about what he does. But he said, sometimes just walking out of your house at the wrong time, if, Border Patrol is busting someone, then that might be interpreted as you were the snitch who got those people busted. Remember, this is right on the border, and a lot of people have family on the other side in Mexico, and they don't, necessarily trust law enforcement, that they won't get reported or, that there might be corruption and it would filter back to the neighborhood.
We also talked to residents in Roma about how they feel about President Trump's border wall. And aside from the policy angle of it, there's also this practical matter of where and how it's going to be built.
Well, a lot of them, were aware that this is going on, that there's a project that's underway both in the Roma area in Starr County and in neighboring Hidalgo County. They've already issued contracts in Hidalgo County, and construction is due to start in February. In Starr County, a lot is still unclear, and in Roma in particular, part of the reason we went there is that there's a lot of houses, whole streets worth of houses on the side of town where we live that are right facing the river in the path of the wall. And what a lot of people would like to know, regardless of their opinion of the wall, is where is it going to go? Is it going to go where my house is? Am I going to get relocated? Am I going to get compensated for the land? Am I going to get moved somewhere? Because it's, difficult for them to envision a lot of them living in another neighborhood when where they are now, they can walk to shops. If, some of them don't drive or they're elderly or they've lived there all their lives. Some of them, their, parents and grandparents had lived there. So I heard a lot of those questions, and I did see kind of a spectrum of opinion. I mean, one of the people who I talked to had voted for Obama, but then she voted for Trump specifically because of immigration. And another person I talked to is a police officer who supports the wall, and his property would be affected. And he still, would like to have more information, as would the other woman I talked to. And then there's other people who oppose the idea of a wall, not necessarily because they oppose added border security. A number of them including one of the gentlemen whose land will be affected, said they'd just like to see the money go for more border patrol agents or more technology like sensors or lights instead of a wall. So you have a lot of variety there. But I think the unifying theme is people would like to have more information about what's going to happen.
Well, thanks very much for the series, Molly, and thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you.
Molly Hennessy-Fisk, Houston Bureau Chief for the LA Times. You can read her articles and watch videos of the border town of Roma, Texas at latimes.com. Coming up, what do most recently elected authoritarian leaders have in common?
To reestablish political order that will be seen as legitimate because it will reestablish the traditional, supposedly legitimate norm that men rule.
The global push to put women back in their place. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave.
No, I wouldn't say I'm a feminist. I mean, I think that would be maybe going too far. I'm for women. I'm for men. I'm for everyone. I think people have to go out. They have to go out and really do it, and they have to win. And that's what and women are doing great, and I'm happy about that.
Well, if there's one thing we can all agree on, it's that President Trump is no feminist. And neither are many of the world's most recently elected authoritarian leaders. In Brazil, there's Jair Bolsonaro. In the Philippines, President Rodrigo Duterte. In Hungary, Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Common wisdom on the cause of this wave of populism usually goes like this. It's the result of resentful working-class voters hit hard by globalism, or it's the last gasp of white Christian conservatives demonizing immigrants and minorities. Peter Beinart disagrees. He's a contributing editor at The Atlantic. He argues that the right-wing populists rising to power across the world have one glaring thing in common: their desire to subordinate women. And Peter, welcome back to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
So I just tossed off three obvious names of autocrats who've recently come to power. Are there more on your list?
Yes, I think the Law and Justice Party, which rules Poland, elements of the new coalition government in Italy. All of these governments, I think you see, have a common feature, which is a certain narrative, discourse around kind of reestablishing gender hierarchies.
Now, before we get to that thesis, just take a step back and we'll look at these commonly cited reasons for this in turn. Why doesn't the economic argument hold that working class voters feel disenfranchised, that globalism has taken away their livelihood?
Well, it doesn't explain, for instance, a leader like Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines. The Philippines has seen really dramatic economic growth, a lot of people leaving poverty. So the general narrative that this is a result of economic slowdown or declining living standards for working people certainly wouldn't explain Duterte in the Philippines, someone who has in other ways a lot in common with these other new authoritarian leaders.
And is that true? Because even in countries where the economies have been doing well, there is an argument to be made that the working class hasn't participated in the upside or hasn't participated in a major way, and that there's a huge and growing wealth gap that's driving a populist revolt. You don't agree?
Well, there may be rising inequality, but in the Philippines, as in China, one can't really say, I think, that globalization has led to declining working conditions, living conditions. These are not countries that had strong middle classes before. They're countries where many, many people have moved into the middle class.
So, and moving on to that second argument, which is basically racism, that voters are attracted to right-wing autocrats out of a backlash against some other, whether it's refugees or ethnic groups or people of another skin color. Why doesn't that hold for you?
Right. It certainly holds in some countries. It holds in the United States. People like Orban in Hungary have certainly demonized Muslims and even Gypsies. But it doesn't work as well in Brazil, where Bolsonaro, Jair Bolsonaro, who recently came to power, although he does have actually some history of some racist statements, actually did pretty well amongst mixed race Brazilians. Nor does it really help to explain the Philippines, again, where racism and xenophobia have not been a kind of important part of Duterte's populist message.
I guess I question whether there is a unifying theory to be had, because you're looking at countries, as you point out, with very different dynamics. And as you point out, in Brazil, one of the things that voters seem to be responding to were that they were sick of horrific corruption in the leftist government. They just wanted change and a hardliner.
Yes, attacking previous governments as corrupt is something you see in virtually all these cases. So that's a common theme. Look, every country is distinct, so there's no kind of unifying theory that perfectly explains every particular situation. My argument is that we have neglected, generally in the United States, in talking about this new global authoritarianism, to focus on gender. And that gender, while not a perfect way of explaining every single different case, is actually a better, if you have to find kind of one universalizing theme that these folks have in common, besides the fact that they're authoritarian, I actually argue that gender is kind of more helpful as an explanatory vehicle than either economic dislocation or xenophobia or racism.
So is the subordination of women a stated goal then among all of these autocrats that you're looking for? And give us some examples of how they're trying to reverse feminism, reverse feminists' gains.
I mean, it's not stated necessarily that baldly, but what you see again and again is an argument that the previous regime was illegitimate, and a kind of linkage of that illegitimacy to the notion that gender relations got out of whack, that women had acquired too much power, that traditional family and gender relations had been subverted. And one of the things that you see with a lot of these leaders is a kind of almost kind of ritualized humiliation of powerful women, women in politics, as part of their macho political ethic.
Yeah, and give us some examples, because in the Philippines, it's particularly striking.
Yes. So one of the things that Duterte has kind of made his name on has been a series of really astoundingly appalling statements, kind of several statements kind of suggesting that, you know, Philippine soldiers could rape with impunity. This was something you see a lot in Italy as well, that the deputy prime minister talking about, kind of mocking an Italian female politician and talking about making a comparison between her and a kind of sex toy. So this is something that you see a lot in these cases, Bolsonaro as well, a kind of a hyper macho politics, which I think sends the message to people that women are going to be taken down a notch.
And in Italy, you also see it in terms of legislation. There's anti-child support legislation and also prosecution of women who accuse husbands of domestic violence if the courts don't get a conviction against the man. So you see it instituted in law.
Yes, this is right. It's not only rhetorical, but in a variety of ways in different countries, you see this effort to kind of repeal women's rights and reestablish a kind of more traditional gender dynamic, whether it's Orban, who basically says that he'll pay the college fees for women, but only if they have several children, or in Italy, as you say, to kind of effort to kind of rewrite child support and divorce laws to make them much more disadvantageous to women, or as I argue that in the United States, that Trump's very important alliance with conservative white evangelical voters has been very much around a particular agenda around the role of women in society and about restricting things like abortion.
Well, the way you put it, you say that all of these leaders, Trump, Duterte, Orban, Bolsonaro, that they all use gender, and this is a quote from your article in The Atlantic, they all use gender to discredit one political order and validate another. So they're using it, it sounds like a political strategy or even a shorthand.
Yes.
Why would that be so effective? Why does it strike a note?
My argument, and I'm really taking this from a political scientist at Texas A&M named Valerie Hudson, whose work kind of helped me think about this a lot, is Valerie Hudson argues that if you think about the kind of long history of governments all over the world, right, going back into ancient times, they've been ruled almost always by men. And there has been this kind of ancient political bargain in which men allow themselves to be ruled by other men on the condition, this is kind of the social contract, that they will maintain their dominance over women. And so this association of male rule with legitimacy is something that runs very, very deep in many, many societies. And what you find is that when people want to delegitimize a regime, which is in a way what people like Bolsonaro and Trump are doing, they're basically saying the political order that we've had was illegitimate, they link that illegitimacy to the illegitimacy of women's empowerment and basically promise to reestablish political order that will be seen as legitimate because it will reestablish the traditional, supposedly legitimate norm that men rule. And I think that's one of the dynamics that you see playing out here.
And that's what makes it such a powerful dog whistle, really, that it taps into this lizard brain of reassurance and legitimacy.
Yes. So, for instance, revolutionaries have done this historically. So during the French Revolution, Marie Antoinette was kind of depicted as the kind of symbol of all that was corrupt and wrong with the French monarchy by revolutionaries. And so they were linking the allegations of corruption and oppression to the notion of female power. Similar thing happened with the Iranian Revolution in 1979 with the Shah's sister, who was, again, became a kind of a figure that the revolutionaries very much focused on as kind of symbol of the illegitimacy of this regime. And I think that, in a way, that was the kind of thing that Donald Trump did with Hillary Clinton and that people like Bolsonaro and Duterte and Salvini have done with powerful female politicians in their countries.
Well, what's an effective strategy for feminists or for anyone to fight back on this? Because the more empowered women appear, the more right-wing media and politicians usually spin that to their advantage. You know, they label women as too strident or hysterical or getting above themselves, uppity.
Right. So I think this was the dilemma that I think that people that we face, right, is that, of course, empowering women is crucial. And yet what we've seen in many of these countries is it's not as if these backlashes were taking place in countries where women had never had any political power. To some degree, it was precisely the fact that women had managed to gain some degree of political power. Brazil, for instance, had a female president. Philippines had a female president that created the environment for this backlash. And so what I argue at the end of my piece is that one of the critical things to understand is the relationship between the legitimacy of the state and the legitimacy of dynamics within the family, which is to say that Hudson argues that our original template for government, for authority in a country, is authority within the home. And one of the reasons that so many people tend to think, men, but even some women, see women's political power as illegitimate, as somehow kind of an inversion of the rightful order, is because their notions of authority have been created in the home. And that if you look at countries where, and that many of the countries that have seen these authoritarian backlashes are countries where women have achieved some political power, but where gender dynamics in the home are still very traditional and patriarchal. And that the best way to kind of inoculate a country, I think, from this kind of backlash is to make the kind of progress that you've seen, for instance, in Scandinavia, where you've created more equality inside the home. So therefore, when women are more empowered at a national level politically, you don't have this disjunction between home and state that can make women's political power seem illegitimate or somehow threatening.
Well, so we're talking about changing things in the home, like who does the housework when and how much and childcare and who cooks. Doesn't that all take generations to translate into political clout?
It may well. I mean, I think these are long term changes. There have been, of course, societies. If you look at, you know, the evolution, again, you know, Northern European societies since World War II, that have made pretty dramatic changes in this regard. And not surprisingly, those are also countries where we don't see the same kind of misogynistic backlash against women in political power. But yes, this is not the work of unfortunately weeks or months, it's the work of years and decades. But I do think that, as I say in the end of my piece, I think what it shows is that this kind of old feminist insight that the personal is political, that what happens in people's private and personal lives is related to what happens politically on the wider stage remains true today.
Well, thanks for the article, and thanks for taking me through it today. Appreciate it. Peter Beinart is contributing editor for The Atlantic, and that's where you can read his article, "The New Authoritarians Are Waging War on Women." Coming up, guess where Hanukkah is a pretty minor holiday? Israel, of all places. We continue our series on holiday celebrations around the globe. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Well, Press Play's producers come from all over the world, and this week we're having them explain their holiday traditions. Yael Even-Or comes from Israel, where the holiday season looks nothing like it does here, she tells us. First of all, Christmas isn't a big deal in the mostly Jewish country, obviously, but Hanukkah is celebrated quite differently as well. And Yael joins me in the studio today. It's wonderful to have you here across the table from me.
Hi, thank you.
So what was Hanukkah like for you as a child growing up in Israel?
So we would mostly light the candles, you know, 4 nights, or we're not that good about it. So we would do it like 4 or 5 nights on average, definitely the first candle and the last candle. And we would eat fried things.
Well, that sounds like a great, yeah. great 8 nights to me. But, you know, here we have Hanukkah decorations and there are, you see, menorahs around and there's some Hanukkah lights. And is there any of that kind of, you know, ancillary marketing in Israel?
There is, but it's so modest in comparison, if that makes sense. I think it is about Christmas, right? And it's about how this takes place around the time Christmas is and how big and out there in the public Christmas is, the lights and the gifts and the shopping. So because we don't have any of that, I mean, there are Christian communities in Israel, but they are still minority, and Christmas doesn't really take place around where I grew up. So Hanukkah is there, but it's not that much in the public sphere as it is here.
So when you came here, mm-hmm. did that just blow your mind? How
yes.
people celebrate Hanukkah here?
Yes, I think the whole holiday season thing just blew my mind. And mostly I was surprised by the fact that people knew about Hanukkah because they don't always know about other Jewish holidays. So I was like, why Hanukkah? Like, I mean, and I've seen some stuff in popular culture before. Like everyone knows about Chrismica from the OC. But it was just like, you know, I always have to explain Purim, for example, which will be easiest to explain by saying it's kind of like Halloween because we wear costumes. But like for kids in Israel, Purim is like a bigger deal usually.
Okay, so if a kid were ranking the holidays in
yes.
Israel, Purim, that would be number one.
So I actually called up my sister, Roni, in Israel, because I wanted to talk about some of the Hanukkah traditions and make sure I remember everything. So, yeah, I actually asked my sister that. Here she is.
Hanukkah is like it's a nice holiday, but I think kids love the most Pesach, probably, because it's a big vacation. I think kind of like 2 weeks or 2 weeks and a half. Purim is not like a big vacation, long vacation, but I think kids like to like dress up and make some costumes.
So Hanukkah is not, I don't think for most people is like definitely, or for most kids is definitely like the number one holiday, which I think in the U.S. it is.
Yeah, and I can hear just the amazement still in your voice. So do you understand? I mean, I understand why Hanukkah has caught on here, but what do you make of it?
So I actually looked into it because I was also, I mean, even here at KCRW, I was asked like a couple of times to talk about my holiday experience and the way I celebrate Hanukkah. And I was just like, yeah, I don't know. We just light the candles. We eat those stuff. We have a few costumes. But like, why all these like holidays special now that I need to talk about that? And I actually talked to Jonathan Sarna, who's a professor of American Jewish history at Brandeis University. And he explained how actually, in the old America, Hanukkah wasn't a big deal at all. But when Christmas grew and expanded and started to be celebrated widely by the late 19th century, there are records of Jewish people talking about it and realize they have to respond. And, you know, there are other factors, like it's the time where the idea of Jews as people, as nations, starting to be, again, more popular. And so they saw Hanukkah as a way, or the renewal of Hanukkah as a way to kind of make that point.
Oh, that's really interesting. So they chose that one because maybe did they think Americans can relate to that? You know, it's like the counterpoint to Christmas. And
And I think there's something about the story of Hanukkah. And I think it might be similar to Christmas in a way, like the idea that it's not kind of purely religious, but it, you know, it took on other meanings that are kind of more national or cultural.
Well, growing up, I know that, you know, it was so unfair to the kids who were Jewish and they felt so terrible and they wanted to get presents too. And that I think that really played into it. And also the fact we are a commercial, I mean, it's America. This is a commercial culture.
Yeah. So that's another thing that was surprising to me, that kids here get gifts, because we never get gifts in Israel. But instead, we have something else.
On the first candle, we get some money, which is really nice, like Hanukkah. Not Hanukkah money, but...
So she didn't know how to say it, and I had to Google it too, but it's Hanukkah gelt.
Hanukkah gelt. I knew
that.
Yes, I know. And I'm not Jewish.
I know. Well, we have a word in Hebrew that it's hard to translate, but it's kind of like translating into money if you don't know the word gelt.
Yeah.
And she actually also reminded me another tradition we have in our family.
I always remember that our mother always gave us like chocolate coins. So she gave us like money in an envelope, and also for a joke, like kind of a joke, she gives us also some chocolate coins,
which is also called Hanukkah gelt. That's what we called Hanukkah gelt here.
Yeah, and which I only realized now, by the way. But she would like trick us to think that we don't get any money this year. We only get the coins. And then there was like a second envelope, and then we'll get the money.
Oh, cute. I bet that was really effective. Did you fall for it?
At some point we stopped falling for it.
Well, generally speaking, then it just sounds like everything is kind of bigger here when it comes to Hanukkah.
Yeah. It seems like for kids it's better, but I would say there is like one thing in Israel that is bigger. And since it's actually changing and it's growing a lot every year, I wanted to ask my sister about it as well. So here she is again.
The donut industry is crazy. You can see it everywhere. And also you can see it like a month and a half before Hanukkah. So you can eat it like a month before.
The donut industry.
Yes.
Yeah, and I've made donuts at Christmas with my Jewish friends.
Really?
Yes. So, but I didn't realize that was, so it's just advertised everywhere. Everybody's selling donuts.
Yeah.
Everybody's eating for the whole, what, month of
So, yeah, we call them souvganiyot.
Yes, it's a jelly-filled donut.
Yes.
Yes.
And the thing is, in Israel, that we don't have kind of donuts on a regular basis, you know. We actually had Dunkin' Donuts coming to Israel, and they didn't do well, so they had to leave. So it's not like part of our diet, really. And then Hanukkah is like the only time that you eat all these donuts. And they got so elaborate. They look so nice. They have different kind of toppings and fillings that people are just getting crazy around the month of Hanukkah with the different donuts. And every year they start eating them like earlier.
Right. That's called the donut creep, the holiday creep. Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
That sounds really delicious.
It is, actually.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was really fun hearing that.
Great. Thank you.
Yael Even Or, Press Play producer.
Rock of ages, let our song praise your saving power, you amid the raging.
That must be our new audience feedback theme. Oh, there it is. Hi, Christian Bordal. What's
up? Hey there. Well, you talked earlier with Vicky Montes. She's an English teacher in an LA public school, about the possibility of LA teachers going on strike.
I remember.
Yes. And so I asked listeners what they think about the prospects of teachers striking, and for parents, what they'll do if it happens. Frost Barnes says teachers play such an important role with our kids and for the betterment of society overall. If the strike does occur, I'd support them and have our child continue to study from home. Chandra Prater says, I'm not crossing a picket line. If a strike happens, she's staying home. And Ivan Munoz says, I will figure it out even at my extra expense. The teachers need smaller class sizes and a bump in pay. LA Media focuses on the raise aspect only, but the shrinking class sizes is really important.
So a round robin of opinions there.
Yes.
Well, thank you for that, and thank all of you for your opinions. And before we go, though, it's the season of giving back, and one way you can do that is to join, renew, or upgrade your membership here at KCRW. And remember, when you make a tax-deductible gift to KCRW today, your gift will be matched dollar for dollar, courtesy of KCRW board member Sari Kane, and you'll help give a voice to fact-based independent journalism and thought-provoking cultural programming. So go to KCRW.com/join, and thank you so much for this, and thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.